All right. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Commander and Coffee podcast, where there's always something brewing. I'm Chris.
I'm Billy.
My name is Y. Again. Now and forever.
Well, it's really cool to see Drew is back again, and we're here to talk about another exciting topic in the CEDH-EDH space of Magic the Gathering. And today's brew is all about mana bases. That's right, today we're going to talk all about lands, mana, all that fun jazz, those useful tools to cast those spells that we also love to play with today. So that's what this episode's all about. It's going to be all about building mana bases, improving mana bases, numbers, ratios, all that fun stuff. But before we get into all that and start talking about it, how you guys doing? What's going on? What are we drinking? How's our coffee life? What's going on here?
Good. No, I want to start off with the coffee. While it's in our hands, nice and hot. I can edit it later. I don't care. But it's right here, right now. I'm going to take a sip and not spill it everywhere. While I sip, this is Billy's coffee. It is a gift I got it for him for his birthday. I'm really passionate about this one, even though it's not mine. And because of that, I'm going to let Billy talk about it first. Tell us about the coffee in your hand, or maybe it's already gone.
The coffee that was or is in your cup.
All right, so to keep on brand with the challenge that was presented to me by Chris, I had this morning, because I knew I was going to have this coffee tonight, I bought myself a Dunkin' Donuts pumpkin cold foam cold brew, pumpkin cold brew coffee, to keep with the pumpkin spice trend so graciously challenged with. It was standard. It was literally a Dunkin' Donuts cold pumpkin cold brew. This coffee, however, it's from anybody who ordered this from Onyx Coffee. It's called the Echelon. It's one of their special brews. It is probably one of the smoothest coffees that I've ever had. It's nutty without being too overly nutty. Smooth as can be. I've brewed it two different ways so far. I love it. 5 out of 5.
It's in a gold foil box, so it's like, wow, that's the one I want to get for a gift for someone, right? And didn't really know much about this one. I've purchased kind of the ones that have been in my budget in the past from this company, the $15 to $25 range. This is a little bit more than that, but I mean, it was an occasion, right? You always want to make sure you have something in your back pocket that you can splurge on when it comes to this kind of stuff. So it came with a little card that tells you about like a brew guide with weights and times of doing the whole process to make it the way they recommend. I did do that the first time we brewed it. We have a Chemex, and I did a little bit of a pour over experiment to follow the recipe, see how it turned out. It was a really exciting one to try black. To me, Billy has his palate and his opinions on it. What I got on my end, it almost reminds me of when I had Cascara, which is kind of like a tea-adjacent coffee. It uses the coffee fruit just as much as the bean. You kind of use like the husks to make that one. And yeah, I was getting some kind of tea notes and maybe some tartness at the end in the way that like a berry would be tart. If you ever had a fruit tea or maybe like a sour cherry type of tea, it had notes of that to me, and I really enjoyed that. And what I think is really exciting about this one for me personally, that's all the flavor that I get when I drink it black. If you add the slightest hint of milk, I've done it with unsweetened vanilla almond milk, and just now I'm having it with oat milk. You put the slightest hint of milk in this thing, and it gets a beautiful vanilla body to it without even trying. So, yeah, thumbs up. 5 out of 5. 10 out of 10.
Yeah, definitely a good one for the week. Cool. So, kind of getting into our main talking points here today. Like I said, we're going to be talking a lot about meta bases. I think it's a good learning point for a lot of our listeners. Hopefully, you guys can learn something from this, but really diving into making sure that we can cast our spells and do what we need to do in our games, right? We've seen the games where you get mana screwed or you're missing colors or any of that. So we'll kind of dive into what we perceive as our best practices and some tips and tricks that we've experienced throughout our tenure to just kind of help educate and empower you guys to build better better mana bases throughout your decks.
What's the coffee without the beans, and what's a magic deck without the mana?
Ooh, I'm so glad I let you talk first.
Why?
Because like it was like that's a great summary. My minor thing is like first thing you said is that it's an exciting episode. Like my pushback is that it's like maybe it's not the most exciting concept in the same way that like changing the oil on your car isn't exciting. This is your maintenance, right? Whatever deck that you will ever build, and maybe a deck that you have together right now, this is how you do all the cool stuff. Knowing how to cast your spells on curve. I think this is a conversation that really hits home the most for people who have played EDH, who are getting new to CEDH, and really optimizing the whole concept of optimizing. You look at individual cards and like, this is strictly better than this, and the big combos, the flashy stuff. What gets overlooked a lot of the time is optimizing mana bases. Having the best in slot lands, having the ability to optimize your success rate of casting the things that you draw, having more keepable opening hands, which lets you be impactful in your games. It lets you do all the fun stuff. But in order to get to that part, there's some homework, and that's what we're going to talk about today.
Oh yeah, I agree. This is definitely, you know, fundamentals, the basics, right? Like it's not fun, but the dividends that you gain from having a good mana base really, really let you kind of do all kinds of the wacky and crazy powerful stuff you want to do. So really good insights there.
There is cool stuff, right? Like lands are cool. It's a whole legacy deck. Legacy lands is almost a cult following. So there is a market for really cool stuff you can do in that area. So I guess you can say like these are fundamentals plus. It's talking about the basic math, but we're going to do a little bit more than your average three paragraph summary.
Yeah, so looking into the topics today, we're going to talk about these in a lot of contexts. So obviously the type of deck you're playing matters, the amount of colors you're playing, right? So a lot of these are going to be tied into context of monocolor decks, two-color decks, three-color decks, four-color decks, all the way up to five-color decks. You can kind of learn and educate some different practices and some different trends from there. So to kind of kick it off, I guess I'm going to open it up and ask the question, how many lands? What's the average number of lands you guys are looking to play in your CDH decks? I know it's different deck to deck, but where's your baseline minimum, and where's your, oh my God, that's too many, I ain't putting another land into this deck.
All right, so mine right off the bat, I am known for having the land problem of never getting enough lands, whether it's my shuffling, whether it's, I have no idea what. But my floor is 25, my ceiling is 30, depending on the deck, of course.
Yeah.
My average is 28, between 27 and 29.
And I think it's important to kind of put in context the decks that we tend to play, right? Like our go-to archetypes, right? I feel like, Billy, of all of us, you play the highest rate of mana dork decks, right? Derevi's your thing. You're like most likely to be running a Gaia's Cradle out of us. So I feel like your low land count, your like 28, 29 land deck can be reflective of the fact that you play a lot of mana dorks. You're playing a lot of turn one Llanowar Elf stuff.
Oh, absolutely. But I mean, even in my current deck that I'm running, it's only 20, I think I'm on 29 lands right now, and I've run two mana dorks in it. So, but it really is deck dependent on what it goes. When I had to run Winota for a recent tournament, yeah, I was on 28 lands and then plus the two modal dual face cards. So I was at 30 lands technically. But yeah, it all depends on the deck. And you are correct. I typically do like to run green in a lot of things. So mine is based on roughly, okay, I'm going to have dorks, I'm going to have artifacts, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm going to tell you this, that's not even the craziest ones. You should see some of Chris's.
I'm going last. What about you? Why? Where are you at?
Yeah, I feel like not even just out of this group, I feel like in the CEDH format as a whole, I think my average is usually like a good one to two lands more than the average person. I got into CEDH with high land, like land synergistic decks in the first place, right? Like Tatsuyoma is my claim to fame. And I was playing, I think I was running like 35, 36. I mean, I don't do that in an average deck, but I mean, I started high.
34 is actually what you ran?
I ran 34 in Tatsuyoma. Am I crazy?
You ran 34? Yep. Nope. Listen, we worked so hard on that deck. Like, you don't think I have that shit memorized?
I mean, a 34 feels like a 36 at this point.
Exactly. Plus you run the dorks.
Yeah, right. So I was on 34, I guess. Very cool. but like that's still like pretty way above average, right? I still feel like when I'm building just a new deck from scratch, I'm looking to start off with like 30 lands and then adjusting, usually taking one out, but sometimes I'll stay at 30. We're going to go into this as we discuss, but I feel like my 30th land is almost always taking up a spell slot for my deck. Like, I am actively choosing to run land number 30 over a given flex slot spell in my deck.
That's an interesting theorem, because I was going to bring it up when you were done, but there was an old verbiage, like back in the day, old man Magic player status here, where like what pros would do is they would go on like websites and they would take a deck list, and then the first thing that the pro would do is they would cut the worst card in the deck, the 60th card, the worst card in the deck, and slot in one basic land, basically, before they went into like Moto Leagues or testing leagues, because their goal wasn't always to cast a spell. So it's kind of interesting that you're kind of implementing that same mindset when you're building your deck, right? I'm going to cut like this worst card. Why would I play this really bad card when I could instead have another land to help cast my good spells?
Yeah, that is something that it's more of a subconscious referencing at this point, but I know exactly what you're talking about, Cypher. And yeah, it is a carryover from the 60 card formats that I played more in the past, not so much anymore. You know, maybe I come back into favor in the future on those formats, but like it is a concept that I took from a lot of 60 card formats, whether that be Pauper or Modern or some Legacy that I'm dipping my toe into. I think it's really important to have that consistency when you go into the mid to long games. And I do tend to enjoy the more mid rangey centric CEDH deck. Right now I'm really enjoying Curious Control. Tatsuyoma, I feel like, is a more mid rangey deck as a whole. A lot of the green creature decks, anything with like Stax pieces or anything with like an Ulrod Collector Roof, anything like that, I feel like I want to be running more land, because I want to have that ability to take a game action every turn. I don't want to be saying draw go when I have a grip full of instants and I'm being bottlenecked into casting one spell per turn cycle. I do like the idea of having a land drop within, I don't know, like a huge success rate. Like, I really like the peace of mind of having a land drop on the first 4 or 5 turns of the game. Playing fast combo, that's a different conversation, but playing anything slower than that, I really like having that peace of mind, and because of that, I'm on more lands to ensure that.
I would say, as a more of a mid-rangey kind of deck, your goal is to actively hit your land drops in order to help facilitate your game action, so that makes a ton of sense.
Me and potatoes. If I get to the point in the game where I'm taking a minor action and holding up some kind of reactive spell on a given turn cycle, that could, in theory, be putting me ahead of 3 other people. Just being able to have 5 lands in play can be doing a whole lot for you.
The common theory is the person who plays more spells in a given game will win that game of Magic, right? By being able to hit those land drops, you're effectively putting yourself in a better position to do just that, right? Because then you have more mana per turn, you're able to produce more mana, do more things, have more actions, make more choices. So it generally does lead to overall better games in some regards.
You make a really cool point with that, actually, because there's more than one way to cast more spells than the other players in a given match, right? If you're looking at Storm decks where you're chaining rituals and fast mana, you're building your storm count in one single turn and chaining spells together in a burst of mana. In many ways, that's a way to cast more spells than other people that we see a lot of. But when there's stacks involved, now you can't do that. And now just having more lands in play is now the winning strategy, right? So I guess in a way, you know, if you're looking at all this in context, in a way, my preference is to hedge against stacks by playing more lands and less explosive stuff.
Yeah, makes a great point. I guess it's my turn now. So if we're going by 100 card singleton format CDH decks, the lowest amount of lands I can honestly say I've piloted consciously is 18. And the highest I usually go is around 28. 18 is an exception, is a weird corner case scenario. I typically end up around 24, 25 lands is to where I want to be. Again, I'm typically a storm player, and the last thing I want to see is more than like 2 to 3 lands. I don't care about them. They don't mean anything to me. They're just tools to get me going, right? After that, I don't care. They're irrelevant. So I really only want to see about 2 or 3 in a given game. So I don't need that many, but that's about where I'm at with lands, typically speaking. I like to try and, you know, make mana through other means, fast mana, other ritual effects, and then make sure I have a higher density of action spells, right? It does come at a sacrifice, right? I will play a lot more cards that make quicker mana. So things like Dark Rituals, Rite of Flames, Cabal Rituals, all these lands. I'll play probably more rocks than my other two co-hosts here will pilot in a given deck, and worse versions of them, because I want that just quick explosion of mana more so than everybody else. Well, you know, someone like Y here is making sure that on turn one, he has one land. On turn two, he has an extra land. On turn three, I'm trying to go from 1 to 5, right? That's where my goal is as quickly as I can. So that's why I tend to play less lands, because they are trying to play a much longer game than I want to play in a given game of Magic.
Yeah, I tend to rank things by how many turns on average it wants to win. For instance, Chris likes to win on turn 1, 2, latest 3. I personally like to win on turn 3, turn 4, and Y tends to like to win on turn 4, turn 5. It's a neat dichotomy that we have here. Not dichotomy, because that only represents 2. It's a neat trichotomy. There we go.
I didn't want to see either of you play my 18-land pile and just hate yourselves when you mulligan.
I'm pretty sure I remember playing that, and I think we, like, you played 2 games with that and then bumped it up to 23 lands, and you're like, ah, much better.
They're irrelevant. You just need, like, 1.
It reminds me, like, you know, when boxers are cutting weight for the fight, right? And, like, right before their match starts, they'll have a piece of toast with honey on it.
Exactly.
you're the 18-land deck is just, like, you jumping rope with garbage bags on you.
So, when looking at lands, again, as we talk through multiple colors, multiple different archetypes, what are some? Do you guys have any, you know, hard and fast rules when you're building land bases? Are you, you know, all fetches all the time? Always need basics. Any kind of general rules or guidelines that you guys follow besides quantity of lands that are important to look at?
Yeah, the one thing immediately comes to mind when you say that, like, because I don't know if Billy, you're thinking of this. But, like, I drive Billy mad with my fetch land choices in some of my decks. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I was going to bring in fetch lands myself, but mine are a different reason. I tend to just put that whole conversation, I take it, and I bottle it up with my emotions and put it in the back of my mind, so that way I don't have to think about it. Why?
That's okay. Just mute me for the next, like, 30 seconds or so.
That's fine. You're
good. We don't have to visit trauma today. That's not what this podcast is. Maybe next episode.
When I was 10, no. Childhood commander trauma. Chris used to blow up my bounce lands for no reason except for they were bounce lands.
You said they were good. I said they were not. And you didn't listen to me, so I made you listen to me.
I am a child of divorce and an art major. I know all about trauma. Anyway, fetch lands. My shtick with fetch lands is when your deck isn't playing Brainstorm, a lot of the cuteness of fetch lands has diminishing returns, in my opinion. Think about a 3-color deck. Something like, I don't know, Mardu, right? Let's look at, like, red, black, white, for example. I look at the least important color to the deck. A lot of these decks, they're running white as a splash color for silence in many cases. So a lot of the time you'll see white as the least used color. So I'll be looking at my off-color fetches and cutting the white one before anything else. So in that Mardu color EDH deck, the Windswept Teeth is probably the first one I'm looking to cut as far as the land base is concerned. In a world where Opposition Agent is continuing to be a card, you are exposing yourself to a lot of risk for not a huge reward in many cases. And there's a give and take to it. And as I think we kind of summarized already, I tend to err on the side of caution with my land base. And one of those ways I do that is by maybe not running every single viable fetch line.
For me, I think there's a give and take to it. I tend to err on the side of I'm going to play as many of those as I possibly can. To Wise point, I don't think I've ever not put Brainstorm in my deck. I think it's a busted card, so it's in pretty much every deck I play. But I tend to like to have the ability to, you know, shuffle my deck if I need to, tutor the correct color of land, because essentially a fetch land is every color your commander can basically make with it in play. So there are benefits to them as well that I find are useful. So I'm a big proponent on if your deck can support 10, you should probably play all 10. If your deck can support 7, you should run 7, so on and so forth.
At the end of the day, like it's kind of funny because you look at all your $50 plus fetch lands, right? At the end of the day, Command Tower is still your best land as far as mana fixing is concerned. How many Command Towers does your deck need? I think we'll get into that a little bit more. But yeah, that's kind of like the big idea that I have is how many Rainbow Lands, how many Command Towers does your deck need? How hungry is your mana base? And then, yeah, you can visit, like, how many fetch lands do I need to make this deck functional, to make it worth the risk that I'm taking by running all of them?
Exactly. And I think that leads into kind of looking at some common traps and pitfalls that I think some of us have seen when we look at deck lists and look at brewings for what they look like. And I think one of the main things I really wanted to talk through here with the group here is, you know, when I look at a lot of decks, and I'm going to use monocolor decks as an example, but this definitely applies to things like 4 and 5 color decks. I think people get a little more scared in those numbers, though, but I still see a lot of them is people are playing far too many utility lands in their deck lists. What I see a lot of people do is, you know, you take like, I'll use Dorks as an example. Take like a mono green deck. Take like a Yisan deck, for example. You know, I'll see that deck packed with things like Ancient Tomb. I'll see it packed with things like Mouth of Ronum. It'll be packed with like all kinds of War Room, Urza's Saga, the whole nine yards. And then it'll have like every one drop green dork under the sun. You should probably play more green sources in your deck in order to cast your spells, right? And that's what we talk about when we go through this stuff, you know. So you always want to be cognizant when you're building these mana bases and kind of looking through what they're doing as we talk through this is to, you know, when do you want to start playing Magic? And how early do you need the colors you need to have? So one of my early recommendations, one of the things that I always look to do when people ask me, like, what do you think of my land base? Is you probably cut some of the cute utility lands and just play other lands that Command Towers, you know, dual lands, shock lands, we got those, you know, battle bond lands. You want to cast your spells that you need to have, you need to produce colors to cast those spells.
I think the best example out there, look at Legacy. I think Wasteland is the perfect example of what decks can afford to run utility lands and which ones cannot. Wasteland, insane card. Watch any trophy league, you'll see it doing work. But if every mana base could support it, every deck would be running 4 of them, right? Delver has to make sacrifices to run Wasteland. You have to make sacrifices when you play Wasteland. And now you can take that into CEDH and any other land with an ability, right? Can your deck afford to run this many colorless sources proportionally to your entire deck? The resources are out there, and as it is with CEDH, it's important to be able to translate what you can from formats with more aggregated data available. So look at, I mean, honestly, you can look at standard mana bases just for like a reference tool of utility lands. Just find a standard format that runs. Help me out. What's a good standard format with utility lands in it?
Probably Pioneer, because you have the Lotus Field combo decks and stuff like that.
Lotus Field combo is a pretty decent example, I think. Maybe like Dominaria Kaladesh block, even, because it was running it was like the mono black deck, and it ran all like the colorless mana doubling, and half the mana base was like colorless sources because it had to be. And the other half was just like basic swamp. It was a really cool deck, though.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen in EDH, speaking of swamp, basic swamp, that was another topic I was going to bring up. I've seen so many people playing like Lake of the Dead with like 4 swamps in their deck, and I'm like, what are you doing? You're just not going to be able to use that effectively. Like, you need to think about what your mana base is trying to do. and play those lands appropriately.
Yeah, I mean, for like a Lake of the Dead, using that example, I mean, you really want to be running at the maximum, and that's in like Jundlord Windgrace, you know, and that's the three colors. Like, if you're running that in four colors, you're stretched so thin. Yeah, you get access to the Alpha Beta Revised Duel, Limited Revised Duels, and your Shocklands as well, but like, do you really want to sack it for three for four black, potentially? I mean, I know I got a lot of blowback when I did my Kirik mana base, because I ran zero fetches in there. Oh, well, don't you want the deck thinning? No, I want my life. Like, that pain, that one life was actually more detrimental to me than thinning my deck, and a deck that I just tutored a whole bunch of things out on. Like, yeah, I didn't care about thinning it. Like, I think I ran 27 or 28 lands off the top of my head. But, like, sure, taking out one or two lands would have been great, but I'd rather have the life.
Deck thinning is, like, sounds amazing in theory on paper, right? And, I mean, you can't ignore that there is a percentage improvement in your deck quality once you've cracked a fetch land. In the context of an entire game, there's so much more going on than removing one card from your deck can really make up for. So you have to consider all the moving pieces here.
Yeah, and going back to Wise's point about the legacy lands and stuff like that, like, there's a lot that goes into the thought process of a 60-card mana base. A lot more than even like a commander mana base would be, but you should really take that notion and bring it over to Commander. You really should just take that, okay, well, you know, I want to make sure I play my Dork on turn one, so I need to make sure that I have X amount of green sources. And the tools are out there to help you do so, to help you figure that out for yourself. Moxfield is a great one for that. It'll tell you everything you need to know about your mana base for the deck itself. That's how a lot of times when I'm thinking, like, I mean, I can keep track mentally in my head because when I was growing up playing Magic, I did a lot of drafting and a lot of limited. So I was keeping track of my mana pips and everything like that. And that's how I learned how to personally build my mana base off that. And then I just add my utility stuff afterwards, my command towers, my fetch lands, my everything else. So there's a lot that goes into it. And to Wise point again, like, yeah, Wasteland's great, but not every Legacy deck runs it, because you need the other stuff. Like, Cavern of Souls, that's also great to, you know, if you want to jam out an Uro, it would be great to jam out an Uro or something like that, but you can't fit it in there. That deck's so tight, you know?
Yeah, you're gonna play Cavern of Souls on turn one in a Easton deck. You're going to name human, and then you're going to stare at the Birds of Paradise, Llanowar Elves, and Findorn Elves in your head, going, what am I doing?
Before we get too far away from the point, Billy brought up an excellent point. In my opinion, I know we're talking about CEDH, right? That's the main context of it's the main context of the whole podcast, right? But like, this conversation, I feel, lends itself the most to limited. If you figure out your mana pips correctly, if you know what your mana base requires in a given deck, your drafting potential gets so ridiculously better. You run circles around people without the same knowledge as you. Just being able to, like, say, cast a spell on turn two, cast a spell on turn three, cast a spell on turn four, knowing what colors and what lands your deck can support as you're drafting, it's incredible, the win rate that you can get from having this this knowledge.
And what's cool with that, personally, that I find, is I've been playing a lot more four- and five-color decks myself, personally, in Commander, and knowing that knowledge and limit it, because, well, it's limited, you don't have access to everything in four or five color, it's kind of the same concept. So I'm able to translate my limited knowledge, my you know, limited draft sealed knowledge, and bring it up to my five color and go, okay, cool, I know what I'm going to need to fix the curve in my hand, you know. This way I could play everything on curve to potentially win the game easier and not have to worry about my mana.
Quality of life improvement right there. And, you know, when you have this kind of stuff downloaded in your head already, that's time that you can now spend on, like we said, this is now time you can be spending on the fun stuff. If you already know what your mana base requires, now you can be looking at your spells and your creatures and just straight up gang to play testing.
This is me stepping up on my soapbox for a minute.
Hold on. No, I'm going to step you down off the soapbox and I'm taking over your soapbox for a second.
Get off my soapbox.
No, this is my soapbox right now. Nope. So when I was growing up playing Magic, Chris honestly did teach me pretty much everything I need to know on Limited. I had a very cursory knowledge of it, but like him and I used to run house in our local, our LGS. Like, we, during the cons block, we were a force to be reckoned with. Theros block, same thing. Like, nobody could touch us. We literally sat there, stared across from each other, and said, okay, I'll see you in the finals, and drafted our decks face up, and nobody could stop us. We just said, stop us. And they couldn't. And a lot of that is because we understood the mana bases. That comes from the mana bases. That literally, like, you know I said jokingly that, you know, that he used to blow up my bounce lands. He did used to blow up my bounce lands. That's 100% true. But it was to get me to understand that a bounce land was a 2-for-1. Countering my Haro was a 3-for-1 at that point. You know, and in my early days and early development of Commander, I didn't realize that. Another neat thing that him and I used to do, so I could pretty much still almost recite my entire my original Derevi list from heart, because we used to sit there and study it like a midterm exam to know every single thing. It's very important to know what you're fetching for, what you're tutoring for, what's on each situation. And I still carry that to this day in everything I do. Same thing with my deck currently. I know what I'm tutoring for by looking at the table and everything. And again, like why I said, by understanding my mana base and knowing my mana base, I can now take that portion out of my brain and set it aside and do that on muscle memory. And I can think about what I'm tutoring for. Think about what the next two turns are going to look like. It's one of those things that, like, again, it becomes muscle memory, just like riding a bike. You can have your soapbox back.
Thank you. So all of that is factual. The one thing that I do want to preface, and I'm sure we'll do a whole episode on this because I could talk for hours on this fact, is this is a PSA for your mana base to help it. Please stop putting in so many color pips of varying degrees at the same time. If you're playing a high color, 4 or 5 color deck, be considerate to your mana base. Your mana base can only do so much. It can only pull so much weight. So if you're playing a deck with Dothi Voidwalker, double black, if you're playing a deck with Mana Drain, double blue, your Grand Abolisher, double white, you decide to put in Final Fortune, which is double red, it's like, What do you do? And you want to play dorks. You want to play Birds of Paradise and Llanowar Elves. Like, you need green on one, double red, double blue, double black, double yellow, double everything on two. Like, you can't do that to your mana base. You have to craft a deck that can also function and produce a good mana base. The harder you make your mana base, the worse it's going to be on you. And then, you know, I see things on top of that where people are putting in those utility lands on top of that while trying to cast those spells, and it blows my mind. I don't understand how you expect to play Magic with those hands. So,
but Chris, didn't that old gum commercial say double your pleasure, double your fun, double it with double your pips?
No, single pips.
I think that was KY.
Oh.
make your mana work. And again, we'll talk all about, we have another episode, spoiler alert, lined up. Eventually we'll do something on card evaluations and I'll talk more about that. But from the mana base episode, always be consistent with what you need in the proper time frames. Yes, you can play some number of those spells. I'm not saying it's bad in those higher color decks, but you'd want to look for options like that, because having a better mana base will ultimately make your deck function better than playing the more powerful cards. I'm telling you guys, I've gone the research. I've lost numerous games trying to jam these cards in. It's not worth it. Don't do it. Switch that mana drain for a delay. You'll have a much better experience. I promise.
We have another friend who's also playing a 5-color deck and will text us every so often and go, hey, you know, I lost this. I'm going to put Grand Abolisher in there. And we're like, well, white's your, you know, 4th color and you're already spread really thin. And he's like, well, I'm going to put, I make double black pips. Or no, what was the one he wanted to do? Necropotence in there. And I'm like, sir, that's 3 black pips in your 5-color deck. And he didn't quite understand it until we went into the full discussion that Chris is talking about, which actually is the thing that gave us the idea for the next, one of the next, you know, down the line talks about
future episode
evaluation. Yeah. So like, because the thing is, if he's thinking like this, and I mean, we all thought about like that once in a, you know, all many moons ago. So like, we're like, well, there might be other people out there. And if you think like that, that's okay. We're here to help you out.
What I find really funny about the format is a lot of the decks, like a lot of these like four or five color decks that are running Grand Abolisher, it's because they have other ways to cheat it into play. It's way easier to cast a Birthing Pod or a Neoform than to hard cast Grand Abolisher in those decks. And yeah, that's why they kind of get away with it. I think it's like a misconception. People new to CEDH, maybe it's you, valued listener, you look at the database and you see all the diverse options in terms of like number of colors. There's a lot of, because of how good partners are, there's a lot of good four color options and obviously a lot of good five color options. A five color CEDH deck looks not just in terms of card quality, but color pips and the distribution of colored cards completely different from a lower power or like a pre-con five color deck. In many cases, you see less than five white cards, less than five red cards, keeping it to the bare minimum. What are the absolutely stupidly best cards that you can't afford not to play, and not going further than that?
Yeah, and that's what's important, right? Like, again, if you're playing Abolisher, but there's Neoforms, Eldritch Evolutions, Birthing Pods, stuff like that, that makes more sense. Like, I can justify that. But if you're planning to hardcast a Grand Abolisher in a four-color deck where you place three to four other white cards, I have some questions and some reservations. Because you are not fetching white lands. You're just not. It's the lowest priority on your docket.
That's the summary. Yeah, basically, you should not be planning to hardcast Grand Abolisher in those kinds of decks, right? You should be planning to, you know, Neoform or Pod into it. Or, I don't know, Court of Calling.
Cast a Silence.
Play Silence, play Orb Shit, stuff like that, absolutely. So that's my rant on there. We'll talk more about card evaluation later, but just wanted to preface this here because it really does help impact your mana, right? Being able to play more of, if you're playing like a Grixis core with splashing white, being able to play more Grixis colored cards, you know, blue, black, and red cards, and less white lands will ultimately help smooth out your mana and allow you to cast your spells. Looking at another common pitfall and trap I see, and I'm curious to see how you guys are. Obviously, monocolor has it pretty easy, and I think two-color kind of has the same junction. But when looking at three, four, and five-color decks, how aggressively are you guys putting in basics to play around things like Blood Moon and Back to Basics?
Used to be a lot more.
Yeah, significantly used to be a lot more.
Gained knowledge and wisdom with age.
Correct. Yes. And I think that's a great talking point for where we're at, right? I used to be very big on that. I used to be like, oh, I got to put like a forest in my deck or, you know, an island or something like that in order to handle the Blood Moon or Back to Basics. But now I realize I just want to cast my spells, right? It's more often than not in a game of Magic, in a game of Commander, there is not a Blood Moon or Back to Basics online than there is online. So I would rather have better mana more often than not than the one time when I don't. And then I can leverage my artifacts and my other sources to produce the colors that I need to help play around those effects later on when I need to. But saying, oh, if this happens, I'll be good is not going to be beneficial to me. I understand it's scary and I understand it sucks when, you know, you're playing a five color deck, you have all 10 of your beautiful dual lands in play, and then they slam a Blood Moon and they're all mountains. That sucks. But you'll win way more games when they don't play that, if that Blood Moon never shows up, than if it did in the first place. So it's not necessarily in three color decks. I very rarely do unless I have an absolute need, and I'm absolutely never putting a basic land basically in four or five color decks unless for some reason the commander requires it or some effect requires it, but I'm not actively looking forward to putting basic land in any of those decks.
Until they put Blood Moon in the command zone in this format, I'm not really trying to build around that.
You have Rocco could tutor up Magus of the Moon. There you go, Blood Moon in the command zone. Play around it.
You're not wrong. No.
But no, I honestly, like, to that point, you should not be playing especially a basic mountain in a five color deck or a three color deck. Like, if you're that afraid of Blood Moon in the deck that runs Blood Moon in it, you're doing something wrong, to be completely honest. Like, Blood Moon and Back to Basics, while the idea of them is scary, the thing is, it really doesn't matter. Like, either A, win before it, or B, remove it, or B, counter it on the, or C, counter it on the stack. I don't know my alphabet. I just play Magic. like, counter while it's on the stack. Like, you don't need to deal with it. Like, and the thing is, so if you think it's hurting you, it's probably hurting someone else a lot more. Yeah, do you run into people who just like, oh, it's a Blood Moon effect, I'm just going to play the Blood Moon effect? Yeah, that happens. I mean, you're also going to get to play against Timmy's Dragons sometimes too. You know, it's things that are certain, taxes, death, and somebody killing the rule of law before they combo out and letting someone else combo out.
It's the same token of like too, for those of you listening, you should not be putting Blood Moon back to basics in any deck that's more than one to two colors. And I sometimes think two colors is a stretch personally, but I'm a crazy person. You know, because you're making your mana base worse to play this card, and you're more often than not, it is not going to be in play. So think about it in this context. If you are a three color deck and you're putting in Blood Moon, that means you have to play a high density of basics in your deck. And that means that 100% of the time you're playing as Blood Moon is in play, because your mana base is built. That's how it's crafted, which means you're straining your mana base, which means you're straining your deck building construction, and you're going through that. Whereas your three other opponents are only playing under that Blood Moon, what, 25% of the time? Every time you cast it only. Every time you cast it and it resolves is the only time your opponents are playing against that Blood Moon. So your opponents have better mana and are significantly playing less likely under Blood Moon versus you, who has that actual Blood Moon in your deck.
Quick exceptions, you know, a ton of Timna, Blood Pod, but like decks like that have other supporting factors. It's not just the fact that they're playing Blood Pod. Their whole deck is being built around Blood Moon-esque abilities and the entire 98 cards. So if you want your whole deck to revolve around that card, then go for it. But yeah, just as like a random card in your deck that doesn't have synergy, I think that's like what we're referring to here.
Yeah, no, absolutely. There's exceptions to everything. Always there's exceptions for everything. No matter where you're at, whether it's playing Commander or Life, there's always an exception for everything.
I wanted to save us a couple dozen comments on that, though. That's all. I just want to get in front of that.
No. It's good that you're being proactive with that. But
so what's interesting is with the change of the format and the way the format is growing, Blood Pod actually cut Blood Moon from its deck. It doesn't play it anymore, so it can play better mana.
That's sad, actually. That's depressing.
Yep, it's a completely different deck now. But yeah, it's not on Blood Moon or Magus of the Moon effects anymore.
I don't disagree entirely with that decision, but man, End of an Era, now it's just like...
Now it's Metapod, right?
The colloquial term.
The pod in Blood Pod is now all about, you know, the podding effects, and then the blood is, I don't know, but it's not on Blood Pod.
Gentrified Blood Pod.
But yeah.
Hashtag bring me back Blood Moon and Blood Pod.
it actually, while sad though, it does paint a picture and kind of helps... You know, hit home with what I was talking about is like even decks like that are cutting it because they're trying to improve upon their mana. Don't stick yourself playing fully under a card unless that card is really going to be able to do a lot of legwork for you.
I mean, the only active deck that I mean really that I know of that's running the Blood Moon-esque effect is Winota right now. It's running Magus of the Moon. I mean, there's probably a couple other ones, but like the top performing deck, one of the top performing decks is that's all it's running. It's just the Magus. It's not even running Blood Moon. It's just Magus because it hit it off Winota and cheated into play.
Winota doesn't cast spells, though. It just
exactly
one spell and then it's done casting spells for the rest of the game.
No, you have to cast an enabler. You got to cast an enabler.
It casts two spells and then it stops casting spells.
That's better.
One for me.
Even my Mogda list, which is mono red, right? The Blood Moon and the Magus. I don't even know which, off the top of my head, I'm not sure. All I know is that they are both 100% cuttable for any other flex slot I'm considering. They are by no means guaranteed slots in my deck. They are not safe. And if they're not safe in the mono red deck, then where are they, right?
Yeah, exactly. And the thing is, like, Magda wants to go faster than taking the turn off for the Blood Moon. You're like, okay, cool. You're putting yourself actively behind on that point.
Yep, so that's a good PSA for people to make sure you're doing that kind of as you go through building your mana bases there. Again, I kind of talked earlier about utility lands into decks. I do think people play too many. I think there are a few exceptions. I think there are a few good ones that are important to play. You know, obviously, if you're a creature-heavy green deck, I think cards like Gaia's Cradle are must-includes in the deck list. You know, things like Ancient Tomb, Cavern of Souls, all these lands are good. Just always be aware of what you're doing when you're putting them in the deck and the reasons why you're putting them in the deck. You know, lately I could tell you I've become a big fan of playing the what I call the soul land. So like Ancient Tomb, City of Traders, things like that in the deck list. And there is a actual cost of them that you have to pay by being, you know, a land that produces two mana, which is great, but colorless mana in and of itself. So typically when you're looking at this, you always want to have a good basis and a good understanding of what your pips look like, right? It's probably the most important thing when you're deciding as to how many utility lands. If you're talking about a deck that is, you know, predominantly pretty heavy, where you're playing things like Mana Drain and Counterspell and things like that, well, those lands, those Gaia's Cradles, Ancient Tombs, you know, City of Traders, they're not going to do you any justice. They're not going to help cast those important spells. And you have other cards like Soul Ring and Mana Crypt and those quote-unquote staples of CEDH that are going to produce that color. So you really want to make sure that you are able to not only have good mana, but also good mana outside of the mana base to help produce the colors that you need and have a good balance between there. So just because a land makes more than one mana doesn't necessarily automatically mean, well, I have to play this land too as well. You know, Gaia's Cradle is a fantastic card if you're trying to cast green spell. If you're not trying to cast green spells, it's not that good. It's also pretty bad on turn one.
Here's a quick thought exercise. If you are a fast combo deck, and there's some four-color Thrasios pile, name your favorite, right? If they're going something like turn one fetch for a Badlands or something non-blue, you should be looking for the win at that point, because there's only so much counter magic that they can be holding up in a turn cycle when you go off at that point. If they are bottlenecking themselves on blue sources, just putting in context what that all means.
Absolutely. The next common thing I see a lot of people doing that I really wanted to get this group's input on is mana bases took an interesting change. I think 2 years ago now, I could be completely wrong in my time frame, but with the inclusion of the modal double-faced cards that, you know, the things like Shatterskull Smashing, Seagate Restoration, Agadeem's Awakening, the ones that are a spell on the front side and a land on the back side. When you guys are evaluating your mana bases and you're playing these particular cards, I guess twofold, I guess my two questions here for the group here is, one, are you always putting these in your deck as a card? And two, is it taking the spell slot or is it taking a land slot when you're building these lands when putting these cards into your decks?
Now, we should preface here when we reference spell slot, land slot, because we said it a couple times already. When we say spell slot, it means it's part of your non-land package. When we say land slot, it's obviously part of your land package.
Your 70-ish or so bulk of your deck.
Exactly.
Like you're playing this over
a Wandering Archaic or a Mana Dork kind of thing.
Yep.
Yeah, or just for clarity and posterity.
Anything with a mana cost.
Right.
If you're saying I'm playing 28 lands and I'm playing a Shatterskull Smashing, well then that Shatterskull Smashing is not part of the 28 lands. It's an additional mana producing source on top of that.
So personally, when I look at them, I slot them in at first, and I count them as a spell slot, and then they're usually one of the first set of cards to come out. That's me. They have their place. I do not want them in a four. I barely want them in a three color. I don't want them in a four or five color deck at all, period. Full stop.
Specifically, resolving a Seagate Restoration, if you're ever in that rare board state where you're doing that kind of thing, hard casting a Seagate Restoration is a really cool thing to do. And taking up, I kind of look at it as a halfway point. It's halfway into the lands, halfway into the spells. I don't really feel like it's one or the other specifically. I mean, that's a success in the design of these things, because I can't really decide which category it really belongs in. So I think for every two of them, I might be cutting one actual spell from my deck. That being said, I'm not really looking to cut multicolor lands for these cards either.
Yeah, I tend to, if I'm playing them, I tend to play them in the spell slots. But for me, I care less about them being a land, and I care more about them being the card that I want, or the effect that I want, right? If I need a mana source and I need a removal spell at the same time, then I may consider something like a Shatterskull Smashing, because it can achieve both of those effects for me when I need it to be either of those effects, right? But like, I'm not putting a Seagate Restoration in my Ad Nauseam deck as a island, because I'm not taking a billion damage off of my island. You know, right. I have no intention on ever being able to fully resolve that card in a game. And if I resolve a Seagate Restoration in a Turbo Ad Nauseam deck, one, holy crap, how did you do that? And two, this game has gone horribly wrong somewhere.
It's ironic in a way that like Ad Nauseam based decks are looking to minimize their land count, but like lands are what you're the happiest to flip over when you're resolving the Ad Nauseam in terms of mana cost.
I disagree with that, but I mean,
it's a free flip every time.
It's a free flip, but it's not a good flip. I wasted emotion, but I'm gonna keep going.
I mean, Carpal Tunnel is a real real killer, I guess, but you know.
Free Mana Rock now. You're talking Chromoxes, Mox Diamonds. I'm listening. That's the thing. Like, don't just jam them in and just say, oh yeah, okay, it's cool, it'll fix my land. If the card's not a good card, it should probably not be there. And if it needs to be a land, it should probably just be a better land you can play, right? It has a little more utility than coming into play tapped. Some prime examples of stuff like in Niv-Mizzet playing Niv-Mizzet Perun, playing something like a Valakut Awakening, right? I think that's a perfectly great addition to the deck list, because I'm happy to cast Valakut's Awakening if I'm winning the game with Niv-Mizzet, or early game I can have it be a land for me. So, you know, that's where I look at those, and that's a pretty good example, I think, of where I look at those modal cards and those double-faced cards.
That's honestly a great example.
My favorite home is Green-White Salvala. Couldn't be happier. I wish that there were more than two of them that came into play on tap for that deck, because it's the perfect card, right? It triggers parlay because the front half is a spell. And you're realistically casting Turn Timber Symbiosis in a lot of games. So, I mean, amazing cards in Green-White Salvala.
So actually, now I'm glad you actually brought that up, because that was where my head went. I didn't even think the Niv-Mizzet one, but that's also really good because it deals everything you want. So you said about the untapped ones. Why wouldn't you run something like a Balaged Recovery in that? In the Silvala deck, I kind of equate that Balaged Recovery, which is it's the regrowth effect, and then it's a tapped forest on the back. To the same thing as the Valakut's Awakening is.
It's absolutely, absolutely runnable. There we go. Here's an example where the untapped ones, and this is my thought process personally, the untapped ones, I'm looking at a land slot in this deck. The tapped ones, I'm looking at a spell slot, because what I am evaluating when I'm thinking about these things is their impact in my opening hand. I want to be casting in Green-White Salvala. I want to be doing a mana dork of some way, shape, or form, or some kind of ramp piece on turn one. Can't do that with the tapped forest, so I'm not really considering that as a land, because the function that it has in my opening hand is not a turn one mana source for the tapped one. If I were to put that one in, Balaged Recovery, if I were to put that in, it would be as a spell and not as a land.
So I think that's actually the perfect segue into probably the next talking point, is playing your spells on curve, playing your proper pips on curve. So like Y said, you know, it's not a it's a tapped land, so it actually doesn't let him cast his Arbor Elf, his Atlanta War Elf, Evanescence Pilgrim, anything like that on the proper curve. So when you're looking at your decks and evaluating your spells in there, you want to be able to play them on the proper curve. Like, okay, yeah, I have, you know, seven mana dorks. I'm not going to play all these tap lands. I'm going to make sure I prioritize that, or, you know, however you're doing it. But that's actually a really good, you know, thought process for that. Definitely good best practice for that. And I mean, I'm just glancing on Moxfield. You guys, we have the tools. We have the tools to take care of this, and Moxfield does a great things of saying, hey, you have 100% chance of playing these cards on curve, and it shows you your mana pit breakdown and shows you what lands, what colors they're going to produce, what you're going to produce in your deck. So it's really neat. Use your tools. We have the tools. It's there. They programmed it. They are wonderful people, and they're actually genuinely really cool people. Got to meet them a couple times. So yeah.
So in looking at mana bases, we talked a lot about, you know, being able to cast your spells and tap lands, untap lands, basic tools and all that stuff. Let's go through each color. I'll give a monocolor, not color, the monocolor, two color, three color, four color, and five color. And kind of tell me, you know, what lands you typically like to play in there. Like, are you in a five color deck? Are you on fetch lands, dual lands, shock lands? You know, are you on pain lands? What are your priorities and what are your preferences when building mana bases for those heavy color decks all the way down to two color decks? Like, do you prefer rainbow lands, like Command Tower, City of Brass, stuff like that? You know, yeah, so on and so forth. So, that being the case, we will start with five color mana bases.
It goes without saying that you're looking to play like Command Tower, City of Brass, Mana Confluence. The two that I think are situational are Tarnished Citadel, which is the City of Brass that you can tap for colorless, or you can tap for any color if you pay three life. I think Tarnished Citadel is a meta call. If your meta, or the general meta, if you're going to a random tournament, if that's more creature heavy, if you're expecting to be attacked in combat more, Tarnished Citadel becomes worse. And in many formats, it becomes just as runnable as a City of Brass. But if you're in Adnaz, I feel like it doesn't make the cut, despite being a rainbow land for your five-color deck. That's the one that I see almost like a 50-50, maybe even less, like a 40-60, not in favor of this card. So that's one card that's on my mind always when I'm building a four- to five-color deck. The other one is Forbidden Orchard, the one where you float for any color and an opponent makes a 1-1. Again, dependent on your deck, I feel like Nigella struggles more to be playing those cards because it gums up your combat step in ways that you don't like. That being said, again, meta call. You're potentially giving someone the ability to cast a Diabolic Intent or a Culling the Weak or a Neoform, having a blocker, right? That's relevant context here. So yeah, those are the two cards that come to my mind in that conversation.
So that's really funny, because Chris and I were actually just recently arguing about Forbidden Orchard and Tarnished Citadel.
Don't let me take up more time. You two argue.
No,
go ahead.
No, that's fine. I'm actually running both of them in my current list. I was testing out the Forbidden Orchard, and I actually, I absolutely 100% agree with you. Those are, in my mind, the utility land slot, along with the City Traders and Ancient Tomb. I also lump in Exotic Orchard and Gaia's Cradle into those as well. The Forbidden Orchard, I'm lumping into there instead of them just being rainbow lands. I'm lumping into there because guess what it does? It allows you to have your opponents block somebody else's Timna. That's the biggest thing that I found with this deck more than anything else. Yeah, you're giving them a spirit to block up your Nigella. Yeah, you're giving them a spirit to Diabolic Intent with, to Infernal Plunge, to Culling the Weak with. It's a risk you got to take from somebody getting card advantage on there. Card advantage is what wins games. I believe, Chris, you remember the old adage, whoever draws more wins more or something like that?
It was something to that effect, but it was also whoever plays more spells, which I said earlier in the episode.
Yeah, exactly. It's all around the same thing, you know. And Exotic Orchard, I am personally not the biggest fan of, because I do not, my playstyle, I do not like to rely on my opponents. I want to basically play solitaire. I want to do my own thing, interact when I have to, leave me alone. And that's kind of how I like to play. And Exotic Orchard is like, it makes me rely on my opponents and what lands they play.
Yeah, so for me, in five color decks specifically, I am looking to play at most, I would say, 2 to 3 utility lands, right? I want 99% of my mana base, 98% of my mana base to be producing colored mana, right? You know, for myself in five color decks, my five color deck of choice is somewhere between Nigella and Kenrith is usually where I end up. You know, pretty topical top end commanders there for that. But the most you'll see me playing from a utility land standpoint is Ancient Tomb, City of Traders, and the occasional Gaia's Cradle. In that deck, I am a fan of Exotic Orchard, and I am a fan of Forbidden Orchard. I don't play Tarnished Citadel in my list for five color, mostly because I am on not and I just don't like having to pay three life to produce a color. I understand it's impactful. I understand you should probably consider it yourself. I just personally don't like that effect. I do like Exotic Orchard in my five color deck because it is a five color deck. So any land that my opponents play will gain value. It's the same reason why in five color decks, even or in most CDH decks, you always see, you know, Gemstone Caverns in your deck list, right? 90% of that, you have a higher percentage chance of not going first than you do of going first. So the Exotic Orchard is typically online pretty quickly to produce colors that you need. Yes, you have to wait a little bit and see for a command tower to come down. But I think in five color, it's a lot more defensible to be played because there's a lot higher probability that you're going to get the colors you need early. Because again, any land your opponents play is going to turn that sucker online for you with at least some form of color producing interaction. And I tend to tailor my decks towards what I think are the premier colors to be playing. Which in my opinion right now is Grixis. That's my opinion. You take it or leave it. But I tend to see more often than not, I can get those colors online pretty quickly with the Exotic Orchard there. So for me, playing those fluffy cards like, you know, War Rooms and all that, Urza Sagas and all that stuff is not even in my wheelhouse when I'm coming into five color. And for me, it's five color. I'm playing the best stuff. I'm not even looking at Shocklands at this point. I mean, if I need to add some extra color specifically, maybe, but I'm pretty much on 10 shocks, 10 original duels, and, you know, my extra five color rainbow lands. And that's pretty much where my mana base looks like.
And let's put it this way, Exotic Orchard, realistically, the worst case scenario that you're expecting to come across is that it's an untapped Triome, which is a better rate than a dual land anyway. So, I mean, in a lot of cases, I feel like Exotic Orchard is better in a five-color deck than it is a lower-color deck. More on the Exotic Orchard conversation, I think it's the most cuttable in a two-color deck when you're less guaranteed to have a relevant thing that it taps for. In four and five-color, they're all relevant.
Spoilers. So, yeah, so that's a good look into five-color. Any changes you guys have for four? I have a few, but I'll let you guys go first. Any differences when you're building four-color decks?
So this tends to be where... This is where Y goes off the walls and starts cutting fetch lands like a madman.
I'm a loose cannon cop who doesn't play by the rules.
I actually kind of go almost the same as I do. I'll actually cut shock lands before I cut some of the utility lands, but it really depends on my commanders. I think when I played Blue Farm, I did not have Forbidden Orchard in there in that one, because that one was important to be able to get through with Timna. And of course, like Cradle and stuff like that, because you can't have that. But like City of Traders and Ancient Tomb were all stars for me.
I think that four color is still within the realm where you can be dropping your lowest used colors in terms of like duels and fetches and things like that. I think Thrasios Bruce Tarl is a good example. It is a four color deck, but I feel like the main color is pretty much green. You want to get your mana dorks, and that opens up all your other color fixing within your 99 or 98 in this case. So you want green and blue primarily, red and white as your splash, because then you have your dockside, your silence, and things of that nature. You probably run a plateau, but you can cut the Sacred Foundry in this example, as long as you have your main mana base situated. You just need like one red pip and one white pip in that kind of deck, and then you're good. So you don't really need to double up on your off-color lands in that case.
Yeah, I'm actually not that far off of that style of approach. I'm not cutting a fetch land. I'm not a crazy person. I do deviate a little bit from my five-color, but it's like one issue cards. I'm still looking to play, you know, about three is where I'm at from a utility land in most decks. I'm still looking to have the Exotic Orchard, Forbidden Orchard, the excess, the Spire of Industry too, which is another interesting five color land if you're playing a bunch of mana rocks. I tend to like that one more than Tarnished Citadel because it's one life versus three, but you have to have an artifact, so there's a little bit more of an activation cost. I don't think it's that much in a format where I play like 20 of them. I'm looking to play the four color decks is the one version where I will start dipping into shock lens, but I'm not looking to play a full suite of shocks. I want my duels to do most of the work, but I will look to play one or two shocks that are in predominant colors. So, like, for example, in a deck like Blue Farm, which is, you know, it still is a turbo Nas deck in some context, right? You're still trying to cast that Nauseam. You're still trying to play, like, things like Underworld Breach, these, like, high powerful combo decks. I'm looking to play things like Watery Grave because I do like having blue interaction up early, and maybe something like a Steam Bench, or maybe like a Blood Crypt, because I'm pretty much Grixis Core splashing white. I'm not looking to dip into the Sacred Foundries or the Hollowed Fountains in that particular color combination, because they're just a little worse than playing something like a Exotic Orchard or a Forbidden Orchard that could, in theory, give you way more colors quicker and accurately than those lands will. So I do like those. And then the trade-off for that, though, is I do think by playing those, I do get to play about three utility lands. I think if I didn't play things like Exotic Orchard and Forbidden Orchard, I would be less inclined to play things like Ancient Tomb, City of Traders, and like Odawara as a land that is actually the reverse of those flip lands, is a land that is more of a spell for me, but gets to take up a land slot and be a land when I need it to be. So that's my quick little rant on those lands there. What about three color decks? This is where I think we can start seeing some different changes in the way you would sculpt your mana base for three color.
Yeah, I think you get to get funky here. I think now you're actually starting to potentially hedge against Blood Moon. I think three colors where you can be looking at basics.
I think so. I think genuinely for me, I mean, we can agree to disagree on this one.
Always.
I think it depends on the deck, but I still think in three color, I'm still looking to just have better mana. Because the more I can improve my mana and not play basics, the more I can play, you know, things that I find powerful in utility land spaces. Like I'd rather be on Ancient Tomb to get some pretty fast starts than to be on a base lands. I think by not playing basics and improving my general mana base, I can get away with things like that a little more. Which is weird to say, because in three color for me, I'm not looking to play the Exotic Orchards, the Forbidden Orchards, the Tarnished Citadel, stuff like that. I'm kind of over those at this point. I think your mana is good enough without those particular effects in play, and you could do fine with just your, you know, your Mana Confluence, your City of Brass, and your Command Tower as your kind of like multicolor lands there. And you get to play a little more utility. I think for me, most of the time, I'm usually around four or five here, maybe four-ish is about the number where I'm going to start playing some utility lands that do some certain things. Like, for example, in a deck to play Rodrak, I'm looking to play things like Phyrexian Tower, right?
Yeah, and I have the freedom to put those kinds of things in there, the lands with a more specific function to them. Because now you're really just like, you get two dual lands or shock lands into play, and you're pretty much fixed in a three-color deck. So you get to do other things with your third land drop and onward.
Correct. This is also the decks where I'm looking to play both the duels and the shocks, right? I'm pretty much on point trying to have all six copies of those in these three-color decks just to be able to, you know, fetch colors that I need when I need them to play. So I believe it's seven or nine, whatever it is I'm playing.
Three color?
It's
three color, yeah, you can do nine.
It's nine. Three color, nine. That's right.
It's 10, 10, nine, seven, five.
Four, but if you're counting things like Prismatic Vista or whatever, then it's five.
That's actually what I want to mention, is that's my other big point I want to make on three color. I feel like three color is that weird threshold where the power of your fetch lands is starting to get worse, and now the viability of Prismatic Vista is going up. And I think when you get to two color, the Vista makes a lot more sense, like in a very clear way. But when you're at three color, that's when I think you're really questioning how many fetches you want to be on. Playing Prismatic Vista gives you more fetch lands in your deck to make your brainstorm better. One small interaction, but like, it's something worth considering.
Yeah, I definitely don't hate it. I don't think there's anything particularly wrong with that school of thought. I just tend to lean to wanting to be able to cast my spells a little more. So I'm a little more heavy on fetches, a little more heavy on the color fixing, and lets me get away with playing some different cards into my deck lists. But I don't think there's anything wrong with playing like a basic or two in a given three color deck, but I would probably go more than one to two. I don't think you want to play one of each, you start going crazy with it there. But I think one or two is not unreasonable, where I would be like, what are you doing? Moving down to two color, for me, this is where basics come in. I'll be point blank. This is the number one type of deck where I'm actively going to start slotting in some basics into my deck list.
This is where I'm more considering more than maybe one or two pointed basics like I would in a potential three color deck. I mean, unless you're playing something like Jorn and then you're running a bunch of snow basics, but that's, again, the exception to the rules. I tend to still run all the fetches. I also tend to run, like, the more direct utility lands. So, like, what I talk about with that is, like, we mentioned Lake of the Dead. That's a prime example. Lake of the Dead, if I'm running Gitfrog, that is a great card in that deck. I'm not going to run Lake of the Dead in something like Old Stickfingers. Actually, no, I probably would. I lied. I would run an Old Stickfingers. I don't know why I said that. But anyway.
Why do you need us? You can just, like, argue with yourself?
I can argue with myself. It's
what am wonderful. Why am I here?
I mean, I tend to argue with myself very often. But, like, a lot of the utility lands, they more are dependent on which ones and which, you know, where we want to look. Still want to run the Ancient Tomb, the City of Traitors. Exotic Orchard, I'm looking to cut a lot more. I think why I mentioned that earlier in the talk. Forbidden Orchard again.
I'm definitely not playing it in two.
Yeah,
you're, exactly. You're rolling the dice a lot on if your opponents are going to be lining up in a way that you actually get a dual land, because if it's just a, like, you run the risk of Exotic Orchard in a two color deck just being a single color land without a basic land type, which is the worst of both worlds, right?
I think this, yeah, I agree. I think this is also the deck where, like, the things like the Battle Bond lands are like 100%ers, like, they're always in the deck lists, right? Interesting theory. Where do you guys stand on things like City of Brass, like Rainbow Lands, right? So, like, Command Tower, Mana Confluence, City of Brass, those kinds of things. I know we talked about Exotic Orchards pretty much on the chopping block. I'm assuming things like Forbidden Orchard are as well, but are we still playing those? Are we still playing, like, City of Brass, Mana Confluence?
Pretty much, as far as, like, my thought process goes, I put them in the same time as everything else. I think there will eventually be a day where there's enough redundancy in those two-color lands, those two-color untapped lands, that maybe you'll eventually shave the City of Brass or the Mana Confluence. We're getting closer, and I think Pain Lands have started to go down that route now. You were always running a Pain Land 5 years ago, and now that Battle Bond lands and the Horizon land cycles complete, things like that, I think, have kicked those Pain Lands out of the question in some cases. Because you still want to run your utility lands, and you only need so many duels in a given deck. There's a certain point where you just don't need four identical duels in play to do what you need to do.
Yeah, still waiting on the Horizon lands to complete, though. They haven't done the allied colors yet. They only still have Horizon Canopy, but...
Yeah, I guess I'd just say, like, completed more.
Completed more, yeah.
It's more robust now.
So let me ask you this question, then, just for our listeners. Why is something like a City of Brass or a Mana Confluence better in the deck than something like a, you know, Pain Land or a, in this case, like a Filter Land... that, you know, you can then convert into other lands, or the flip lands, for example. Like, what makes why would you potentially slot a City of Brass and Mana Confluence in over any of those lands per se? Because they kind of do the same thing, right?
I kind of view them on the same level. There are definitely times when I would rather have the Pain land because it taps for a colorless at first, or the Pain, you know, one or the other. Whereas Mana Confluence and City Brass tend to, they always cost you the Pain no matter what you're doing with it. So I kind of see them in the same vein. Could I slot them in, you know, in a pinch over, or could I slot a Pain land in a pinch over it? Yeah, absolutely. I see no problem with that.
The one thing I would say is that City of Brass and Mana Confluence is relevant when you are, let's say, for example, I think Gilded Drake is a great example of a card that you see a lot of. Praetor's Grasp. There are times where you need to make colors outside of your normal color identity, And it's a corner case, but it's one that, you know, the opportunity cost might be worth it.
What's also really funny is I actually won a game, won a tournament on the back of being able to tap somebody's City of Brass infinite times. So that was pretty cool.
Yeah, I tend to think you do want to keep those in for that exact reason why that was a great pull. You know, if taking the, you don't know what's going to happen in a game. So, you know, usually life total is a resource, obviously, but, you know, having access to being able to have a land that can produce a color outside of your normal colors is slightly more beneficial than, you know, the occasional I can use this as a colorless source down the line there. Obviously, contextual matters, but I don't think it's egregious to play a filter land over a City of Brass or a Mana Confluence or a Pain Land or something like that. But I think if you're going for highest percentage points there, they still hold strong on that approach.
I also have like an irrational fear, like again, carrying over from Modern, I have this irrational phobia of Hive Mind. There's one person out there still running it in tournament. I will find them and I will be ready for it.
I look forward to that day.
Same, actually. I would love to see that.
So, moving on down to our final color, mono color decks. I guess, first of all, are we playing City of Brass and Mana Confluence in them? I would probably assume no is a great answer. My overarching point is I want to cast my spells, so I'm looking to play as many, you know, whatever color land I can produce that makes sense, right? I don't want to overload and just play 28 islands in a mono blue deck. I need to do other things. I get that. There's things like Odawara, Cephalid Coliseum that, you know, are functionally untapped islands that do something else. So unless I'm playing something like a High Tide, I'm probably going to play other stuff as well. But I am looking to make sure that, you know, starting the game on turn one, I have a high density of blue sources or green sources or red sources or whatever color it is to hit those particular lands. With that being said, I guess my question here is, what kind of utility lands are you looking to play and what kind of are your numbers in a monocolor deck? And the big question is, do you play Command Tower in your monocolor decks?
I'm going to hit you with I guess this is more of a question for Billy, but like, Tainted Pact. That's the reason that you might be on a City of Brass in a monocolor deck.
I mean...
Wait, what?
Yeah.
Hold on,
I
mean, what?
I see what you're saying. Like, I see what you're getting at, and I understand what you're getting at, and yes, you could absolutely run a Tainted mana base in a monocolor deck. It's very complicated, and let me take that back. It's not very complicated. It's not as optimal sometimes. But like, are there certain times that is needed? Yeah. Did I run a Tainted mana base in Kirik? No, not at all. Did I run Tainted Pact in Kirik? No. Did I run Consult? I think I did. I don't remember, actually. It's been a while since I played the deck. but like, it's so few and far between. You are not wrong. The reasons to run something like City of Brass, Forbidden Orchard, Command Tower, Exotic Orchard, Mana Confluence is to fill out those Tainted mana bases.
One of those situations where like you do what you got to do. Sometimes what you have to do is a lot.
Exactly.
You can sell me on that on two color. I on mono color. Oh,
yeah, two color. No. I could be sold really easily. I mean, look at our Vohar deck. You know, that was on a Tainted mana base. You know, there's other things that you could do with a Tainted mana base. I'm pretty sure Gitrog is on a Tainted mana base, if I remember correctly. I mean, I haven't seen that deck played in a hot minute.
I don't know how you physically cast your spells with a Tainted mana base in a monocolor deck. That's a train wreck of a thing, because you only get to play a mountain or a swamp and a snow covered swamp. Oh, good lord, no.
Yep. You're talking about like Tomb of Urami, I think it is, from Kamigawa, from like Saviors of Kamigawa. There's a bunch of funky ones. There's
Urborg,
like
actual
not
Urborg.
Yeah, not even like, yeah, the original Urborg.
Yeah,
don't do this. This is a terrible idea.
Yeah, no, absolutely. There was a deck way back when, this is in the olden times, that was they used to call it Food Chain Gonti. So if Food Chain Gonti makes a comeback, then sure. The way that deck worked is you'd find somebody who in your pod was playing Food Chain, and steal the food chain off them, whether it be with a Praetor's Grasp or Gonti himself, and proceed to combo out using your food chain, your Eternal Scourge, to cast Gonti over and over again. So, like, yeah, technically you could probably do that there, but, like, that's so bad. It's I'm not even going to sugarcoat it. It's really bad.
I'm not going to die on that hill by any means. It's definitely not a deck that I'm looking to play. Just kind of like raising awareness that, like, there are enough sources out there that you can do it. It can be done. Should it be done? Jury's out.
At the start of this episode, you were probably doing it. I hope by the end of this, you are not.
And if you are still, we would like to politely but firmly ask you to leave. But keep listening. It's fine. We still love you.
But anyways, final question. Are you playing Command Tower in monocolor decks?
It's a really cool flex. So, like, you know, you could. If it's just going to be a basic, then I would rather run the basic, because Blood Moon is a card that exists. It is hilarious to run it, but yeah, probably don't get got for the sake of a joke.
If you want to trigger me, you play it, because that's what it does to me. It triggers me every time I see people doing it.
Yeah, there's some times that I like to surprise Chris and be like, ha-ha! I also do mismatched basics in every one of my decks just to piss him off a lot more.
Yeah, I was about to say, especially when you do the Billy special where now, like, you play the color-themed Command Towers.
Yep. He does this to me all the time. He's like, here's the Commander Collection Green Soul Ring and Kirk and the Korean Command Towers.
Yep. I've got a couple of people in on that, too. The old bait and switch.
Maybe you'll get them. Maybe they'll think you're playing Mono Green, and then you, like, just don't look at your Command Zone, and then you get them. Next level plays.
All right. Well, I think that was a very insightful discussion for everybody here as to kind of how the three of us kind of perceive mana bases, and hopefully give you some good insights and some good tips to help kind of facilitate your mana bases going forward. Any last thoughts, anything else from you guys before we kind of move on to the outro and call it a show?
Yeah. So I know I've been stressing this so much. There are tools out there to help you understand your mana base. There are articles. There are websites. There are websites that actually just build your mana base for you.
About Commander and Coffee.
There's Commander and Coffee. We do that too. We're going to have a link to a bunch of those in our show notes here. Please take a look at them. Listen to our spiels on it. Listen to our experiences personally, because we've read a lot of these. Chris and I come from 60 card, and even Y for some of it too, he comes from a 60 card background as well. We all played limited, and we all played limited to a decent capacity. And what's really funny in the limited sense is Chris and I learned a certain way, Y learned another way, but we get to the same outcome. And a lot of that mana base building from 40, 60 all translates over to the 100 card. That's at the end of the day, that's what we want to teach you guys, to let you all know, to educate you on, is your mana base doesn't have to be a main concern. You could put it in the back of your mind if you build it properly. And everything has an article, has a tool. I mean, I currently have 6 tools up right now, or 7. Wait, 1, 2, 3. I can't count. I have 8 different websites up right now, all talking about building a mana base, from people like Reed Duke and Scott Cullen, and even like Jonathan Suck. Oh God, I'm not going to pronounce the last name. That says Suckanick. but like, there's always.
I don't know if we can put that on the podcast.
I don't think I can either. Cut that out. Cut that out, Michael Flores. There's always an article that'll help you understand more than we're doing right now. So that's my biggest ad. That's my biggest ask, I should say, is just become more educated. That's the end of our goal for this podcast and everything, is to educate everyone. And that's really what it boils down to. I'm taking off your step box. Fuck.
And you're done. All right. Well,
My closing thought is, I guess, like, somewhat of a hot take.
Interrupting cow.
Good. If you're trying to play a 4-color, 5-color deck, proxy your mana base, proxy your duels, know how your deck is actually intended to function. Because sometimes it does not, if you don't have that critical mass of fetches and duels and things of that nature. If you are going to an event that doesn't allow proxies, and really, who can afford all 10 duels right now? Not me. Might want to consider playing a 3-color option, 2-color option even, because sometimes the deck just doesn't work if you're asking too much of your mana base. It's a hot take. You hate to hear it. No one likes being told no, especially when they're trying to have fun. But I promise you, for your quality of life, you will have more fun playing a deck. And that's what the whole topic of this podcast is. That's the whole topic of this episode. You will have more fun playing your deck if you can cast your spells when you need to cast them. And sometimes budget is a restricting factor. You got to play around it. Reality of life, it sucks. But yeah, that's my hot take, is play the deck that you can use the correct mana base for.
Cast your spells. I've said it multiple times. Cast your spells. Play mana to cast your spells. That's all I'm saying. With that, guys, I think that is a wrap. Thank you guys all so much for listening and watching. All links will be in the show notes below. And while you're there, be sure to follow us on all of our social media platforms as well. We're always around. We're always happy to talk. Typically, I think our Twitter does kind of a brewer question of the day. We always are out and active on Twitter. All social media platforms, hit us up, talk to us. We'll be more than happy to discuss mana bases with you and talk through that. So with that, I am Chris, a.k.a. Cypher.
I'm Billy, a.k.a. Cork.
My name is Y, a.k.a. Nothing.
A.k.a. Nada. We are all out of coffee, guys, so have a great night. Peace.
Coffee out of me.